Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us. And of course, we are going to be talking this hour about what happened in Nigeria last month with the kidnapping of those young girls from their school and more that have been kidnapped, the situation with Boko Haram, the situation politically in Nigeria that fuels in this entire issue that's facing that country and giant parts of West Africa, the whole question of trafficking in children. Then the really confusing issue people have in this country over the question of Islam and all of this, because when you look at the history of West Africa and of Islam in West Africa, what has happened to Boko Haram, as one woman said in a demonstration, a Muslim woman from Nigeria, Boko Haram is not Islam. We'll talk about that and more with our guests. And we are lucky to have a really great bunch of guests for this hour, and let's welcome them. We are here with Jacob Zen, who is analyst of African Affairs at the Jamestown Foundation. Good to have you with us, Jacob Zen.
Yes, hello. How are you?
I'm very well. Glad to have you here. Dr. Elim Hailu is with us, Associate Professor of African Studies at Howard University. Welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hello. Thank you.
Alexis Okiwowo is with us. She's a journalist based in Lagos, Nigeria. She's been doing incredible writing for The New Yorker. She's spoken with two of the girls who escaped the Boko Haram. She's a 2012 fellow of the Alicia Patterson Foundation, writing about gay rights in Africa. She's also a 2012 fellow of the International Reporting Project at Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies, reporting on religious and sectarian violence in northern Nigeria. And Alexis, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And joining us from Nigeria. And Omoyele Sowore is with us, who is founder and publisher of the much-cited SaharaReporters.com, a website of citizen journalism supplying videos, photos, news stories, and comments, commentaries that expose official corruption and abuse in the Nigerian government. And Omoyele, welcome. Good to have you with us as well. Omoyele, you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome, welcome. Good to have you with us. And you're welcome. Join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner. We want to hear your thoughts on what's happening in Nigeria. So, Alexis, let me start with you. I know you only have the first half of our show with us. I do want to begin with you on a couple of levels, but let me start by talking to you about what you wrote in The New Yorker about the interviews that took place with you and some of the young women who were kidnapped. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I was able to talk to two of the about 53 girls who have escaped from Boko Haram. Both of them were able to escape relatively early on. One jumped out of a truck while the militants were taking the girls into the bush. And the other managed to escape after they reached one of Boko Haram's camps in the bush. And, you know, both of them just, I mean, were still in sort of a state of shock, really, and trauma, because this was, while other schools had been attacked in the region, the girls really didn't think this would happen to them while they were briefly taking these exams. And it was an extremely horrifying experience. These militants showed up dressed as, you know, as soldiers and tricked these girls into coming with them. And once they had them and once they took them away, they already started putting them to work and forcing them to do things. So both girls were traumatized.
And I think it's also important to point out here that the girls were kidnapped, and looking at the photos of their moms in Nigeria, that these young women were both Muslim and Christian who were kidnapped.
Yes. They were both Muslim and Christian. Yeah, it was a mixed faith school, mixed faith region. So, yes.
So what is the latest news from where in Nigeria at this moment? I mean, there clearly is no headway in this, that the Nigerian government has spent most of its time kind of backpedaling and saying some very kind of incongruous things when it comes to all this, and arresting, which we'll talk about, some of the demonstrators who are demonstrating for something to be done. So what is the latest?
Well, I mean, right now what we're hearing most about is that the U.S., the U.K., and France are all sending teams of advisors to help the Nigerian government and the military launch a rescue operation. I don't know what this really means in actuality, though, because in countries like the U.S. and the U.K. have been providing millions in assistance to the Nigerian government for its military to fight this war on terror. So I'm not sure how this time will be different. It really is up to the Nigerian government to figure out why its relatively large military budget is not translating to effective operations on the ground. So, you know, right now we're in a state of limbo, just waiting to see how this assistance is going to translate on the ground.
Yeah, I want to talk a bit about that, too. I mean, I think that that you've written about and clearly Omoyele has written about the kind of corruption inside the Nigerian government and how that plays in and what may be going on between some elements of the army and intelligence in Boko Haram. But we'll talk about that in a minute or two. And Jacobs, then let me turn to you, then we'll go to Alem. I mean, what is it the U.S. can really do here?
What is it that the military needs to do
here? What can the U.S. really do here? U.S., our government.
The first thing that I would say is that there needs to be sub-regional coordination between Nigeria and its neighbors. Because for several years, Boko Haram, just as in this kidnapping of the girls, has carried out attacks in Nigeria and then ran back to Cameroon or Niger, and Nigeria can't really chase them there because it's an international border. But just like what the U.S. sees in Afghanistan and Pakistan, no counterinsurgency can be effective as long as Boko Haram has a safe haven across the border.
So, and Alem, how do you see? Looking at Africa, in all your scholarly work and more, and seeing what the U.S. response is to issues that happen in West Africa, East Africa, or else, what is your sense of what America can really do here, and what the response should be? I was going to Alem right now. I'll come right back. Alem?
Okay. Perhaps we could divide this into parts and carry the other part on the second part of the discussion, but. This provides an opportunity to look into what's been going on, both in terms of what the government has been doing in Nigeria and the regional response, and what the U.S. could also do, you know, in terms of preparing this and making sure that this is not an isolated case, as the Taliban and 9/11 showed, you know, how there should be responses on different levels, on military levels, on other aspects also of addressing this, I think.
I'm just covering the surface of some things to come back to some of these in depth, because I know that Alexis may have to leave early, and I wanted to get to some of the points you raised in your article. But let me start by asking Omoyele. I mean, one of the things that Alexis has written in her article is about some of the possibilities of collusion, as some human rights activists have said, between the military and Boko Haram and other groups. And the kind of stunning news that came out in Alexa's article that one of the UN leaders, Baba Gadir Usman, said that the army left just hours before this happened, and other people saying we knew they were coming. So what do we know about that?
A document that several of these type of collusion between the army and the militants. It's obvious that there's some kind of working relationship with at least some platoons of the army. It happened even yesterday when the army abandoned a border town known as Gamboru Gala near Cameroon, and Boko Haram came in there and operated for, I think, 12 hours, killing about 300 people in the market there. The army claimed few hours after the attack, that they had been deceived by Boko Haram to go in another direction. I mean, that's unbelievable. But largely, the insurgency is fueled by the corruption, official corruption in Nigerian government. We've also documented condition of soldiers who are fighting on the war front, who have abandoned, who have no water to drink, no place to sleep, not even instruments to dig graves to bury their dead. This is how bad the situation is. The thing to say, and which is important for the world to know, is that Nigeria is being run at this time by an incompetent central government, especially a president. As we speak, they are in denial, and they are saying it openly that they are not sure that there's even any kidnapping, whereas the rest of the world is saying it. We have spoken to the parents. We have pictures on our website we took yesterday. The kids went back to the scene of the abduction with their moms, and they were weeping and crying, to about their colleagues. And here's Nigerian government drinking champagne and holding a World Economic Forum in Abuja, very, very unconcerned, and relying on the U.S. And other parts of the world to help them. U.S. is only sending 10 military advisors who are going to be based in Abuja. I don't know how that is going to help free almost 300 girls abducted by lunatics, this terrorist organization known as Boko Haram.
And Alexis, I mean, you wrote, in the piece, one of the pieces you wrote for The New Yorker, you spoke very clearly about people who are alleging collusion between the military and some of the dissident groups. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, I mean, the last speaker just made some great points, which is that, yeah, we've been hearing these reports for a while that, I mean, A, you're dealing with soldiers who are drastically underpaid. And not only are they underpaid, but they receive payments extremely late, if at all, you know, payments that are delayed for months at a time, and who are not well equipped, or at least not as well equipped as Boko Haram militants. And, you know, so you're dealing with a situation where it's become attractive to potentially for money to give aid or to collaborate with groups who will give you money, who will give you enough money to feed yourself or to feed your family. And so the problem is that there's just so much space for corruption on the ground when it comes to this war. There's a $6 billion, you know, security budget. And it's just not clear as to why this money is not going to better equip and to better pay these soldiers. And so, yeah, there is a lot of room for corruption. There's a lot of room for, unfortunately, collaboration.
Well, one other question about that. I want to push that a bit further. I mean, that's pretty shocking given this is kind of a oil revenue-funded armed forces. That's the fourth most powerful armed force, they say, by some estimates, in the continent of Africa, maybe the third, but at least after Egypt and Ethiopia and South Africa. And so it's very shocking that this is that is the news. I mean, it's just, what are we saying here, that how much of a tie is there, do we think, between the kind of corruption and what's going on in the government and neglect of the North and the development groups like Boko Haram? Alem?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Alex. I know you have to leave in a few minutes, then we'll go right to Alem.
Oh, no, I was going to say, yes, it's all intertwined. I mean, you know, the very reason Boko Haram began over a decade ago was because a radical Islamist preacher said that he was sick of political corruption and the fact that people in the north were not receiving the benefits of Nigeria's extreme oil wealth. And he attracted a lot of followers from preaching this. And, you know, for a long time, Boko Haram's grievances have been things that people can sympathize with, even though, of course, they do not sympathize with the way that they've been wreaking terror all over the North. But yes, of course, this is how Boko Haram arose, from the immense corruption.
You're about to say Alem, what?
Yes, this goes to the age-old debate about which of the two broad causes, whether it's structural, as some of their followers say, whether institutions, conditions of inequality, injustice are the major factors. Others emphasizing the human agencies of belief systems, ideologies, political cultures, habits of the mind, or as some might say, at the heart. You know, the UNESCO preamble says war, violence starts in the heart, and that's where it should be addressed. So these two major factors play into this. And when we look at it, we see how it's broader than just the mismanagement of the military, how the failure of the state, the failure of political elites, the expediency, political expediency of leaders who accept democracy only when it goes their way, find it easier to support or help in the mobilization of identities, how the globalization aspect of it, even though Boko Haram is a local thing, how it's been informed in the free flow of arms, ideologies of Salafism, the Akim around the border, how this feeds into the whole idea. So To address it, this have to come into play, I think, both the connection of both the structural, the corruption, inequalities, the suspicion between the North and the South, the ideas of religion, we can go into it, and how this new ideology of Salafism, even though even Al-Qaeda is in some of the reports given today, moving away from it, how they essentially feed into this. In fact, Boko Haram was formed right after the 9/11,
Right.
So we see the global aspects of it and how ideologies are fed, how its connections with Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, in Shabab and others are fed by this free flow of arms, ideologies, and then the criminality, and of course the inability of political elites to really fight this in their behavior, both even in parliaments and in other political figures.
And I do want to touch on that a little bit later as well, kind of the rift that actually is going on inside of the Islamic world in West Africa and in Nigeria, because it's the history of Islam, we'll get to it a little later, the history of Islam in Nigeria is much different than what Boko Haram is advocating and pushing. This kind of Sufi versus Salafist way of looking at the world. But we'll come to that in a moment. And what, Jake, I heard you, what were you about to say?
No, I was talking before just about the security forces and that the U.S. might be able to train a special counterterrorism squad of maybe 100 elite soldiers that can take out the top leaders of Boko Haram, which is what the U.S. did in Indonesia with Jamaat Islamiyah there. But I don't think the U.S. can revamp the whole Nigerian armed forces in under 5 or 10 years, which is probably too late for what we need now.
Omoyele?
Yes.
Alex, just your commentary on what you've just been listening to.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of everything. There's a part of it that's academic, and I respect academics when it comes to discussing what's happening in Nigeria today. But likely, we must not lose sight of the fact that, you know, it's not only in the North that there's inequality and there's been militancy. In fact, the Niger Delta region had a period of almost 6 years or more where there was complete militancy that destabilized and brought the oil industry to a standstill in Nigeria. In different parts of Nigeria, there's crime, there's kidnapping. Nigeria is facing, is reaping the fruit of the kind of bad leadership that has had over 50 years and the massive corruption that's taken away into private pockets over $500 billion in the last 50 years from oil resources they learned. So for Nigeria, as everybody likes to say, it's just that the chicken has come home to roost. Nigeria just cannot escape from the mismanagement of its leaders over the years. So what happens is that every little problem in Nigeria becomes a major problem because of corruption, because of mismanagement, because of the kind of leadership that's in charge and that has been in charge of the place. And unless these issues are addressed, even if we wake up tomorrow and Boko Haram is gone, another small band of criminals, thugs, can just take, I mean, hold Nigeria to ransom. And that's what I've been saying about even returning the girls. When they return, to which country are they returning to? To which schools are they returning to? To which dignity are they returning to? Those are the questions that we must ask and we must force Nigerians and Nigerian leaders to answer. And, you know, we must also force Nigerians to solve their own problems. This idea of relying on the U.S. to come take out our terrorist leaders, to come help us with everything that we need to do, it's just very, very lazy, and it allows leaders to get away with their irresponsibility. So that's my position, and like I said, we can discuss whether this is fueled by ideology. You know, I mean, everywhere criminals want to use one excuse or the other to ride roughshod on citizens, but what makes a difference is the kind of leadership that takes hold in several places around the world where at least there's peace.
And before we go to break here, Alexis, I know you have to leave, Alexis Okiowo, so I would like you to kind of give us some of your final thoughts on where you think we are. And I found the pieces you wrote to really anecdotally interesting and also very moving when it came to the girls, but also your analysis of the human rights and the situation in Nigeria. I think it's important for all people to read. We'll be linking to those articles in The New Yorker. But your thoughts before you have to go.
Yes, I mean, I think that, you know, everyone has made great points about especially how the confluence of both corruption and a particular sort of wave going on in Islam that after 9/11 that led to the creation of Boko Haram, which I think is important to remember as we deal now with how to root them out and to defeat them. And, you know, I think it is important that Nigeria take the lead on this. And and be held responsible for what is an extreme failure on its part, that disconnecting happened and that connecting still like this happened. And I think that, you know, right now it really rests on the shoulders of the Nigerian government. And, you know, not on the U.S. advisors or not anyone else. We really have to just see how the president will take charge of this and see if he lives up to what he owes to his citizens.
Well, I do want to thank you for being with us today, Alexis. You have to go. Alexis Okeowo is a journalist based in Lagos, Nigeria, who's calling us from there. She reports on this for the New Yorker, some really interesting pieces. She's spoken with several of the girls who escaped the Boko Haram, and all the articles are there. We'll bring all that up to you in the next half hour, and we'll continue our conversation with Jacob Zen, Dr. Lem Hailu, and Omoyele Sowore when we come back. So please stay with us, and Alexis, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we're out with Robert Johnson. Come on in my kitchen. He was born on this day in 1911. Stay with us. Dust My Broom, the great Robert Johnson, born on this day in 1911. And we are here with Jacob Zen, analyst for African Affairs at Jamestown Foundation, Dr. Alem Hailu, who is associate professor of African Studies at Howard University, Omoyele Sowore, who is the founder and publisher of the much-cited SaharaReporters.com. And you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, and you can also tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on this crisis facing the people of the world and Nigeria, obviously, and what you think the U.S. should or should not do about it, and what we, in our analysis of the situation, we'd love to hear from you. We know many of our listeners are Nigerian who have something to say about their own homeland. Please join us at 410-319-8888. We'd like to hear your thoughts on this particularly sad affair that's taking place at this moment. So, gentlemen, let me come back to some of the pieces where we left off. I think there's so much here. I mean, first of all, one of the situations that has come to the fore in this tragedy is the growing understanding of what's going on with child trafficking in West Africa, across the world. But right now, we're talking about West Africa. That many people link Boko Haram as not just a militant Islamic group, but as a group of gangsters, and that child trafficking is huge. 27% of all trafficking that people are saying are children who are under the age of 15. Two-thirds of the victims of trafficking were children, another study was saying, and this is huge. So these kids may be being sold. We don't know to who or when. But people say, someone has written an article saying, I can go to certain places in Niger and other places surrounding Nigeria and buy any child I want. So what do we know about this in terms of that and what this means about the fate of these children? Omoyele, why don't you start?
Well, one thing that's very important to say here is that Boko Haram has created a territory within four nations in Africa. That's Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria. And so a lot of people are not talking about this. They're not talking about the fact that they are creating territory. They have 12. So when my feeling is that the girls are with them, they have a reason to keep all the girls together because they want to use them also as a shield in case there's a major military push against them. They want to use the girls as a shield. So they don't have any reason to distribute the girls or sell them yet, at least as far as we know. And the girls that escaped, who some of them we talked to their parents, have said that they weren't even far. They're not too far into the forest. They're right around the place, and the military know where they are. They have bases in Sambisa Forest, which is a former game reserve that the Nigerian government abandoned as a result of corruption as well. So they're there. These people are well known, and they are operating openly, and they have been operating with impunity even since the abduction of the girls. They have carried out more abduction, including abduction of 8 more girls about on Sunday night.
Yes.
So this hasn't stopped. We are not talking about the Boko Haram that abducted girls and ran away and just hunkered down somewhere. They are still operating openly and with impunity. And they've operated up to this moment. They are in control of a town known as Goza. They've been in control of the place since yesterday. So the girls are with them. They are using them as beast of burden. They are using them as shield. They are using them as sex slaves. I have no doubt about that. And so the important thing, as far as I'm concerned, is to for the world to abandon, you know, creation of this, what I would call, you know, acres of hashtag, and actually try and rescue this girl. Really, really go after how we can rescue them. Imagine that these girls are in an ocean liner, and we find they are at the bottom of the river or the ocean somewhere, and we are told that there's a pocket of air, they're still alive. Would we just be sending Twitter accounts, or are we going to send rescue to them? If we can send just half of the number of aircrafts that went looking for this, almost the same number of passengers on an airliner to this part of the world, we would have rescued at least most of the girls by now. So the world needs to act, if they want to act really fast, because the Nigerian government is apparently not interested in acting upon this anytime soon. So it's a little contradictory even for me to be asking for, you know, global intervention. But as far as I'm concerned, what should be uppermost in our mind is how to rescue these girls first and foremost. And I think they're not far. The girls are within range. Some of the parents said they are still getting calls from the girls, from their cell phones.
Really?
As of yesterday, yes.
So the girls who were kidnapped still have their cell phones, some of them.
Most of them have cell phones. You know, most Nigerians have cell
phones. No, I understand that.
Yeah, and they're still calling. They're still calling them. They just keep calling their mom. You know, if you go to our website yesterday, you see pictures of the moms that we put on our website.
I want to talk about the moms and these women demonstrating a moment, too, because you have those photos as well on your website, which is, folks, and I do encourage people when you have a moment, to go to the website, which is full of really interesting pieces, articles and photos at SaharaReporters.com. Jacob and Alana, may I just jump to this as well about what the fate of these girls and the whole question of sex trafficking, child trafficking, it's going on in that region. We can only just hope that, I think that the analysis that Omoyele gave us is correct. These girls are still being held hostage as part of negotiating and as protection. But, Jacob?
Yes. In terms of the fate of the girls, I agree that there's been a lot more resources put into the Malaysian airliner than to these girls, and probably by 100 times. And given that there's been so few resources to rescue the girls, it's not surprising that few of them have, very few, if any of them, have even come back. But it's also not so easy to get them. I mean, are you going to do a special forces operation against Boko Haram, which has tanks, anti-aircraft missiles, and very heavy weaponry? And Boko Haram could easily kill the girls. So it's not as easy as just sort of finding them like it would be to find the Malaysian airliner. Here you actually need to conduct a very sophisticated military operation against a multi-thousand militant Boko Haram force in trenches that Boko Haram is probably more familiar with than even the Nigerian troops. So I'm just saying it's extremely difficult at this point. Boko Haram might try to ransom some of the girls back for tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. Then the problem with that is that Boko Haram can just kidnap more girls like it did with 11 girls 48 hours ago, and then the problem persists. So it's a real challenge, but, you know, someone's got to try to take some strategy to get the girls back.
And Alem, your take on that?
Yes. I think if something good can come out of a tragedy, the silver lining in this is how a human story gives the power of the story to a tragedy much deeper than that. when the bombing happened right before the kidnapping, the head of state, Jonathan Goodluck, made the flippant statement that this is tragic, but we'll get over it. The issue of Boko Haram is temporary. And this is after 25,000 people are statistically believed to have been killed since 1995, about 10,000 years since 2002, half a million people displaced, both inside and in the neighboring countries, which includes a lot of young girls. So this came to the forefront and put the government on the spot and the indifference of the world to a problem that's much deeper. That's why we address it with the immediate cause, that no efforts should be spared to free these innocent girls. But this should be an opportunity as the first installment to address the much larger problem of indifference and other related issues that we should also make sure that otherwise we'll be talking about similar stories every few months.
So, Jacob, I know you have to run here in about a minute or two. Before we go back to Omoyele, and I want to talk about the women being arrested in Nigeria and why they were arrested and what's happened there, and the kind of political situation around that. Closing thoughts from you, Jacob, before you have to run? Jacob Zen?
I guess I have one closing thought, and I think it would be that although, as you mentioned, Boko Haram is not consistent with 99% of Muslim groups throughout Africa or even the world, it does represent a trend that we've seen in Nigeria for the past few hundred years, even the past decade. And that is that when the masses of people in northern Nigeria perceive the Muslim leadership to be corrupt and mixing Islam with democracy or other non-Islamic concepts, there's a tradition of revolution against that Muslim leadership. So Boko Haram is extreme. It does reflect the tradition in Nigeria of, for example, Usman Sodio. And in that respect, it is somewhat very indigenous to Nigeria, despite the fact that it has made many excesses. And I think this is an intellectual challenge in countering Boko Haram's ideological narrative.
Well, I'm sorry you have to go. I'm sorry you have to leave at this moment, Jacob Zen, because I was about to bring up what you just brought up, which is Uthman Danforio and the other historical components of resistance in Nigeria. But I appreciate you being with us, and I'll bring that to our other two guests. Thank you so much for public analyst for African Affairs with Jamestown Foundation. Jacob Zen, it was great to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. But let me pick up where you just left off, Omoyele. I mean, one of the things that in my readings, and I'm not a West African Islamist historian, but I've read a lot, and just finished Grandin's new book, where he talks a great deal about the kind of tradition of Islam in West Africa. And the name mentioned here, Uthman Danforio, but he was a revolutionary who was a Sufi, who ran schools of Quranic learning that also included girls and women, and there was a very literate society that rose up against these oppressors, Fulani and Hausas, that rose up, and under his leadership, that was a real revolutionary movement for freedom that affected a lot of people. So this Boko Haram is something very different than that, it seems to me.
Boko Haram was organized, I mean, a lot of their teachings and their motivation came from the likes of Uthman Danforio and, you know, resistant leaders in the north. But all of this changed when the leader who had been organizing the Boko Haram adherents was killed in a police raid in 2009. That's what changed the whole dynamics in this fight. And also, it's important to let people know that even though they preach against Western education, most of their early leaders were graduates, and they were very, very fluent in English. So it's something that I think they were trying to create, you know, their own enclave, and they wanted to resist their corrupt leaders. They not used to have, you know, leaders who fought and protected northern interests. It was when the military came and followed by the civilian leaders that they created that the corruption took over everywhere. And there's been resistance in every way across Nigeria. It's very important to say this, that southerners, you know, south-south people, southwest people, north-central people, a lot of people are against corruption, and everybody's fighting their own little way. And I think Boko Haram wanted to use religion to fight, but it wasn't the kind of struggle that can be described as liberation because it's discriminated against non-Muslims. And that was where the problem, part of the ideology, came from, that they wouldn't accept anything other than pure Islam, as they define it. So that's very important to know. But again, it's also very important to know that people in Nigeria are just displeased with this corrupt leadership that's put Nigeria in the very, very horrible condition that it is today. And everybody's fighting their own way. And Boko Haram said at the beginning that that's what they wanted to do. But apparently today, that's no longer justifiable, and we cannot use their current action to justify the resistance against corruption, because they have become more corrupt themselves, looting banks and, you know, raping women and killing indiscriminately anybody who didn't believe in the ideology, including killing mostly Muslims, their Muslim brothers and sisters.
And I think that stuff is very important to talk about, because these demonstrations taking place in Nigeria now, and I see the pictures, both on CNN and on your website and other places, that these are being led from like grassroots leaders and other leaders. The woman who's head of the World Bank in Nigeria was part of it. It's leaders of the different communities in Nigeria were part of this, men and women. So I'm curious what you both think about what the response has been and why the response was what it was by the Nigerian government. Alem, I'll start with you, Alem Halu. To arresting some of the women who were in the demonstration, the First Lady of Nigeria, saying that they were lying and that they were offending her husband, they should be arrested, and they were arrested. I mean, it's a bit of madness. All this, almost like a Shakespearean madness, to put it lightly.
I want to start with the issue you framed in the beginning of the question.
Okay, please do.
Yeah. And it is how he said why Islam at this moment is exhibiting this, and this has to do with the what's going on in the global village, what's going on in terms of the politicization of religion, the radicalization of identities, mobilization of separatism. It's highly connected with that, and in fact, many scholars believe that Islam, like many other great faiths, has the core message of tolerance, acceptance, inclusion. But why is this happening? Is part of what Khalid Duran, a renowned Muslim scholar, put it. Islamism, he said, is a late 20th century totalitarianism. It follows the wake of fascist and communist ideologies, picking up from those seeking to reify their methods of domination. Islamists with tradition, moral tradition, so as to serve their political ends. So he points out that even though they speak in the name of Islam, even though in the name of Puritanism, going back to the early leaders, they forget that there were great elements of tolerance, both in its home origin and other parts of the world. As it spread to different parts of the world, it adapted cultures and belief systems that ensured tolerance and inclusion in Asia, in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in Africa. Also, the African mode of spiritualism that respected the trees and the natural habitat. That's why when the Islamists in Mali came to destroy, banning music, which was a key part of Islamic culture, Islamic African culture. So we see this extremism in the formulation, reformulation of this new ideology of Islamism, whether it's in the Taliban form, as many of the leaders pay tribute to it as their ideology, or Ibn Taymiyyah, who was one of the 14th century scholars, who defined it in terms of Puritanism that excluded inclusion, that excluded tolerance. So we have to understand it in this frame, and also show the expediency of politicians. The corruption is rightly pointed out as a key issue, but if corruption and poverty were the reason, all nations in the world would be in brutal crime and violence. This is not to justify that, it's not a factor, it has to be included, but that it's the mobilization of identity, the expediency of politicians using separatism as a way. In fact, in 1999, there was huge corruption during the military days. When democracy started the forms of it, that's when this came in, because many politicians used this. In fact, many of the fighters speak of how prominent politicians funded them monthly in many ways. Politicians from fundraising agencies in Mauritania, and from fundraising Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, the world over have played into it. And when we think of how this has been done, we see, for instance, the failure in the parliaments, the state assemblies, 1999 trying to bring up Sharia, the strengthening of the jurisdiction of Sharia, as a way to fight the things they didn't do. And when Jonathan Goodluck was elected, he was a Muslim, he was a Christian, so many found it unacceptable, but the common people were mobilized by this identity. And we see how this is played up in terms of how mobilization fits into people's feelings, you know, who lived in tolerance and accepted each other. For instance, the Pew Research showed that 91% of the Nigerian ethnic groups considered religion was the most important thing, compared to 76% for Christians. And in terms of trust, 62% Christians said they don't trust people from other regions. The Muslims, 61%. So we see this right. happening in ways that are mobilized by incompetent central governments, political leaders that use this to mobilize. So this should be part of the long-term range thing, and in understanding it rather than confining it to one factor of corruption or mismanagement.
So, Omiya, let me want to kind of talk a bit about the come back to this question of corruption as well, but talk a bit about what's happening with women in this demonstration. You've been covering it. There have been pictures on your website that have been that really people should look at. And I'm curious what your analysis is about why these women have been arrested, why there's been a stamp down on people who are just demonstrating saying, bring our girls home.
Well, the Nigerian government lives in la-la land, as you guys usually say here. And they have been in denial about this. As a matter of fact, there was a report we did about a week into the abduction of one of the party leaders, a female party leader, who came out and questioned if there was any abduction at all. And when we did the story, of course, it was huge public backlash. And they turned around and said she was misquoted, and later she was misunderstood. And some of them turned around and said we lied. But it's, you know, we're used to the Nigerian government playing around with people's lives. And that's why we do what we do, is expose this kind of incongruous position of leadership. They've been doing this within the government, the president circle. Their main belief is that the abduction was stage managed, and it was aimed at embarrassing the president. And the president at this time is that's President Goodluck Jonathan. He's mostly and only interested in the next election, which is the 2015 election, and he sees this whole Boko Haram insurgency, he sees the abduction as something being done to hamper his ability to campaign. He couldn't even declare, and the elections are coming up in February. And so he sees this as some kind of conspiracy against him, and that's the same way his wife feels. That's why you see the public outcry and outburst by the wife in the most callous and embarrassing manner to them. And then next day, we get up and they are receiving world leaders and having parties and dinners, and they shut down the capital city, Abuja, to have a World Economic Forum. There are 6,000 soldiers guarding less than 300 world leaders in Abuja as we speak, whereas they only sent 1,000 soldiers, according to them, to go and rescue the girls. And they haven't even entered the forest yet, because we are in touch with the people of Chibok. We are in touch with the parents. We're in touch with some of the community leaders, and they said they still haven't seen the military carry out any major activity to rescue the girls.
What is the logic behind that, Omoyele? I mean, the political logic, the logic of Nigerian government not acting on this, or not even making a full court press against the groups like the Boko Haram. I mean, what I've been reading is that the one of the reasons that Boko Haram has been pushed aside in a lot of communities is groups of armed men themselves defending their villages is what's happening, right?
Absolutely. People have been arming themselves. They have what they call the civilian JTF in several communities. If the communities weren't protecting themselves, Boko Haram would have overrun at least 3 states in Nigeria by now. The Nigerian army hasn't been able to fight Boko Haram effectively. They abandoned their post, and, you know, like, there's a huge, this level of suspicion that there's collusion between them. We can't even explain it except to explain it within the range of corruption, politics, and inefficiency, generally just lack of coordination at the highest level. You know, you have someone who is supposed to be commander-in-chief of the armed forces who says, at a media chat or press conference, that he doesn't know where the girls are. They have no clue, according to President Jonathan, where the girls are located. And according to his wife, they don't believe that there's abduction of high school girls. They're still investigating and trying to figure out what is behind this. But what we know and what we can report to the world is that the abductions did take place, and more abductions have taken place
every day.
And Boko Haram is active and alive and wreaking havoc on Nigeria's Borno states. Finally, it's very important to let you know that Boko Haram is in charge of almost 10 local governments in Borno state already, where they have full and almost complete control.
What do you mean in charge?
Well, you know, they've installed their own local officials to implement Sharia, to tax villagers and farmers, and do whatever they like. That's been in charge. That's, the Nigerian government has abandoned the leadership of several local governments in Borno state, as we speak, to Boko Haram.
You know, I think that both for political reasons and also to understand that we're also talking about this in this particular case, these children's lives and the families that are just, I mean, emotionally devastated by their daughters being kidnapped. And you can see that. That's why I encourage people to go to Sahara Reporters. I mean, you get a feel and sense for Nigeria and what people are living through and going through, and a sense of what's really going on in ways you do not in most of the Western press and most of the press.
I quickly want to add, because I want to respond to their friend there who said that it's difficult terrain. The place where Boko Haram is operating is not difficult terrain at all. It's actually very easy terrain. Nigeria is just twice the size of California. Boko Haram is in a small state that's probably twice the size of Delaware. With a few helicopters, we can put these guys on the run, and I'm serious about it. Again, it's difficult to accept that, you know, indeed I'm saying that there should be some kind of intervention, global intervention, whereas I strongly feel that Nigerian government should be forced to intervene and save the girls. But if all we can do is to mobilize the whole world to do this, we should as well do this. We might as well just do this and do it well and get the girls to be reunited with their families.
So we have about 2 minutes left in this segment, and a closing thought from you. About 1 minute, my producer is saying, not two. So you're closing 1 minute fast thought, Alem Halu.
Okay. I just want to say that this should be a wake-up call for the government of leading the most powerful economic nation in the continent next to South Africa, feeling helpless with terrorists. And this should also be a wake-up call to not just the government, just the world, but the people of Nigeria, to be involved in not just saying what the government should not do, but politicians, scholars, citizens, being involved and engaged in changing this, because it shouldn't be pointing fingers at one and then saying, you know, why don't they do this? So this should be a very learning lesson while focusing on rescuing these innocent girls.
Well, I want to thank you both. Dr. Alem Halu, it's always a pleasure to have you with us, Associate Professor of African Studies at Howard University, and Omoyele Sowore. It's great to have you with us. I hope you'll join us more. He's founder and publisher of the SaharaReporters.com, a citizen journalism website that you must read and see, and we'll link to it on our website as well. Omoyele, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us today as well.
Thank you so much for bringing me.
And we will continue watching this and working on a program here that we like to present to us monthly here on the Mark Steiner Show, which is to look at issues facing Africa as a whole, and news and culture and more. We're going to go out here with Anita O'Day. In 1941, she recorded Let Me Off Uptown with Gene Krupa and the band. O'Day was one of the most prominent jazz singers of her day, as compared with people like Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan. So we'll leave with her voice. Anita O'Day, we'll be right back. Stay with us as we look at your internet could be going bye-bye. Bye.